Right. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Let me introduce our guests. Mazen Gomsi, a Palestinian scientist and author, joining me from Belfast. Also with us is McNapier, co-founder of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign out of Glasgow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the show, both gentlemen. Now, let me start with Mazen Gomsi. Mazen, as you know, you might have heard this. There are some analysts at the Eurointelligence, I'm quoting them, they say that for us Europeans, this warrant exposes a real dilemma between international law, which is our law, and our foreign policy, especially for those member states that are unconditionally backing Israel. Your take on that, please.
Indeed, this is a momentous moment of truth, if you want, where leaders of countries that are signatory to the convention that allowed the creation of the ICC, that is 120 countries, it's a moment of truth for them. Will they obey this ruling? Or will they obey the lobbies that are working in their countries to affect basically Israeli continued impunity that has been going on for decades now at the international arena? So this is the first test, and hopefully there will be many more, of course, down the line, because it's not just Prime Minister Netanyahu and previous so-called defense minister Gallant who are responsible for this genocide. All Israeli officials have engaged in the genocide to varying degrees, from the president who said basically there's no innocent civilians in Gaza, to the prime minister, to all the senior officials who have egged on the army to kill Palestinians indiscriminately and engage in starvation and denial of medical services. So indeed, it's a test of the so-called Western powers that created the United Nations and its mechanisms. Israel is already saying that this will be basically closing that chapter, so they will change international law. Or according to them, the UN becomes or already is becoming irrelevant.
Right. Now, Mick, the EU foreign policy chief, the outgoing one, Josep Borrell, is arguing that the ICC warrants are not political and therefore they should be respected and implemented. In your opinion, is Europe sincere here or duplicitous, given what's going on the ground, actually?
Well, I mean, the UK doesn't, England doesn't have the monopoly of a long history of consistently lying and cheating. You know, the phrase perfidious Albion, that you can never trust England, English diplomats, is very long-standing. But Borrell, of course, is you know, fits into that very neatly. Look, the question is why the ICC, why Karim, I forget his family name, but the British citizen who was placed at in the position of chief prosecutor at the ICC felt the need to issue these arrest warrants. Arrest warrants were never issued in the past for the most atrocious war crimes committed by Europeans. You know, a million and a half Algerians killed by the French in one single episode of anti-colonial struggle. But you could mention many, many other countries as well, where millions of people were killed by Europeans, and there was never any arrest warrant. In fact, until recently, when you looked at the faces which appeared in front of the ICC, charged with war crimes and crimes against humanity, it was deeply embarrassing because they were virtually all black. It was African warlords who were taken before, with the exception of the ex-Yugoslavia, who were taken before the ICC. But Europeans could do this with complete impunity. And I think the question needs to be asked why, on this occasion, Israel has been singled out. It's not because of the atrocious nature of the massacres of the 50,000 or maybe 150,000 Palestinians who've been slaughtered, because this has happened before quite a few times, but nobody was ever charged. I think the ICC felt they had no alternative, that that what was going on in Gaza and Palestine was so saturating into world, into people's consciousness worldwide, that if they didn't have an arrest warrant for Netanyahu and Gallant and so on, then the whole thing would be useless. People would not respect it in any way whatsoever. So I think there's been a long history of selective prosecution and immunity and impunity for white war criminals. But this simply couldn't be continued in this case, because it would have reduced the ICC to ridicule in the eyes of hundreds of millions of people worldwide. Mm-hmm. Because when you look at the figures now, despite a press, despite a media system which is incredibly disciplined in favour of Israel and incredibly hostile to the Palestinians and how the reality is portrayed and spun, nonetheless, there are large majorities in every European country, I think everyone, and in America as well, who favour a ceasefire. There are majorities in virtually every country, which is in Britain, 2/3 of people think that Israel is guilty of war crimes and crimes against humanity.
Correct.
So there's a price to be paid, and I think, you know, the Karim, the ICC, the British person who was sent into the ICC was seen to be a safe pair of hands, was seen to be somebody who could be relied upon not to rattle the cages in Washington. So now we see the situation that none of us could have dreamt of a year or so ago, where the Americans are talking not just about sanctions, okay, but some of them are talking about attacking The Hague. These are senators, not drunks in pubs. So wide is the fissure between Western practice and Israeli practice on behalf of America, and what public opinion worldwide and even in Europe is prepared to accept.
Yeah, right. Now, Mazen, let's look at the speaking of crimes, war crimes, and all that. This is not what the Israeli officials believe is the case. Gallant, for example, says that he's proud, in his words, of the privilege that he had in leading Israel's secure and defense systems during a time of war. He says that Israel will continue the war until all of its objectives are met. Now, given this, can the ICC warrants in any way stop this Israeli war machine, or at least accelerate the process of bringing it to a halt?
No, obviously international resolutions mean nothing to Israel, and they've already stated so very clearly. The Israeli regime have said even if the U.S. decides to stop supporting them, they will keep going. And that's their closest ally and partner in crime, if you want. So the Israeli regime is one of those regimes that is not concerned much in terms of obeying international law. After all, it violates over 50 UN resolutions in Security Council and hundreds of UN General Assembly resolutions, like the one on the right of Palestinian refugees to return. So Israel violates these laws, and they think they can get away with it because might makes right. Now, it doesn't mean they don't pay attention to this. And indeed, the Israeli government is panicking a little bit on the public relations front because they don't want what happened to South Africa to happen to them. And that is a slippery slope of countries realizing that they can abandon support for South African apartheid and even apply boycott, sanctions, divestments on South Africa BDS. The same Israel is fearful of, that this is a slippery slope towards isolation, towards applying boycotts, divestments, sanctions. This is why the Israeli government is worried about it and is devoting a lot of money to challenge it and mobilizing their chief ally, being the United States. Of course, they are very hopeful that the incoming Trump administration will be even more accommodating to Israeli demands. Hard to see how, since Biden gave them everything they asked for. But they are hoping that Trump will give them even more, including potentially isolating the ICC, potentially applying sanctions on countries that obey the ICC.
Right. Yeah, we'll come to the U.S.'s stance later in the show, too, definitely. But Mick, one more Israeli official's actual reaction to this. Naturally, they have slammed the warrants. The Israeli transportation minister, for instance, called them modern anti-Semitism in the guise of justice. Let's see who's talking about justice. And then, so again, you see this mixing of the issues. I mean, anti-Zionism and anti-Semitism. Whatever happens, Israel doesn't like it. They simply label it anti-Semitic. Your thoughts on that, please.
It's preposterous, of course, but it's now, in many ways, ideologically, the last arrow in their quiver, the last tool in their toolbox to fend off revulsion, hostility, and rage developing against what Israel is doing. And the idea that anti-Zionism, i.e. hostility to what the Israeli state stands for, has done, anything that the state does, is in some way is now framed as hostility to Jews. As somebody who opposed apartheid in South Africa, no crazy person ever said, you don't like white people, this is against white people. The very notion would be the height of stupidity. But that's what's being deployed across the world. And even after the sort of riots in Montreal yesterday by pro-Palestine and anti-NATO demonstrators, the prime ministers are quick to say this is anti-Semitism without a shred of evidence. It is evidence-free, and it's merely asserted constantly, like saying that the sun rises in the west and sets in the east. If you say this often enough, a large number of people might actually believe it, but it has no basis in reality. And this is what we're seeing. So the whole world is anti-Semitic in terms of the Israelis and in terms of Biden and Trump. The United Nations, churches, trade unions, mass populations, anybody who stands up and says what Israel is doing is a terrible crime and that it bears a passing resemblance to what the Nazis did to Jews, anybody who says this is immediately attacked as an anti-Semite. But it doesn't wash. When everybody is an anti-Semite, then the weapon loses its sharpness. And we can see this already. There are a lot of people don't have, you know, have lost any fear of being labelled as an anti-Semite. I, with many others, have been in courts, have been on trial in Britain, charged with anti-Semitism. And the one good thing about a court is you can interrogate and you can cross-examine the people who attack you, and the case dissolves immediately. But they're going to keep on doing it, and they're adding one more thing, which is the pogroms that took place allegedly in Amsterdam a couple of weeks ago. You know, violent attacks on Jews, once again, with no basis in reality. So I think it's possibly because the anti-Semitism weapon was wearing a bit thin that they've started to introduce this new idea of pogroms. Mm-hmm. Equally fantastic.
Okay. Now, Mazen, let's take a look at the way that Europe is acting. You know, there is some, you know, mixed kind of a reaction, like we have a government spokesman, for example, in Germany, saying that Berlin, I'm quoting, will carefully examine the ICC's arrest warrants for Netanyahu and Gelin, but will not take further steps until a visit to the country. You know, Germany is dubious. It says it must examine things itself. But on the other side, we have like Ireland, Norway, Spain, saying that this is binding. They have praised the ICC verdict. So let's talk about this division inside Europe.
Yes, clearly Europe has not been unified in its response to the ongoing genocide in Gaza, and the various levels of partnership with the Zionist regime in the genocide, ironically in Europe, included primarily Germany and England, UK, which have been big partners in Europe with the genocide, France to a lesser extent. And then you can go down the list to reach countries like Spain, which were clearly not very happy with what's going on. Still not in the position that we would like them to be. We would like them to apply boycott, divestment, sanctions on the State of Israel and demand its expulsion from the United Nations, or at least suspension, like we did with South Africa. So Europe is certainly not a unified force on this. And that's, that can be looked at positively. But as I said, even the countries that are symbolically saying they will execute such a warrant are not really pushing in the direction that we would like them to go, which is to apply actual pressure, including denial of flights, including booting Israel off of the United Nations, including, issuing arrest warrants, not just for Netanyahu and Gallant, but for senior officers who are all guilty of these crimes. So I think Europe needs to wake up. This is a danger to Europe because, obviously, of the destabilization that's happening in Western Asia, the so-called Middle East, that they like to call it. Their destabilization that affects migration to Europe. It also, a regional war is likely to expand to a European war, as happened before, and we can see that that will impact everybody.
Mm-hmm. Now, make time up to talk a little about the stance and the reaction that the U.S. has adopted. President Biden saying that the ICC arrest warrants against Israel leaders is outrageous, and that his country will always stand with Israel against threats to its security. The U.S. is also saying that ICC has no jurisdiction over the issue whatsoever.
Well, yes, they're scrabbling to respond to this. They really don't know how to respond. In the wilder reaches of American politics, then it's violence, sanctions, even the crazy idea of attacking The Hague. But it's a real deep quandary. America, before, was found guilty by the International Court of terrorism. It was in the case of Nicaragua, where they attacked the country, mined the harbors, sent in death squads, and so on. And they were found guilty in the International Court, and America just ignored it, passed it on. But it's quite different with Palestine. It's very different in the whole of West Asia. It's very difficult for a government to exist alongside and to accept that a very large percentage of its citizens think that it's evil, think that it's not benign, think that the state is capable of terrible war crimes. And it's not just Israel. Prime Minister Starmer in London said Israel had the right to deny life to all the Palestinians, and water is life, had the right to deny life to all the Palestinians in Gaza. Openly genocidal talk. And that's still working its way through the political system. Growing up in a country like Britain, despite the reality of terrible famines that we've caused in Ireland and Bengal, terrible massacres that we've carried out around the world against brown and black-skinned people, absolutely terrible history, but it's been covered by a veneer. It was capable of being covered. It was capable of being disguised. You know, racism was a powerful factor as well. But it was always necessary to portray our countries as the good guys, and the communists or the Muslim extremists and so on as the bad guys. That's now becoming very, very difficult because of Israel. Because people know that children are being deliberately killed by the Israeli military. Mm. People know that. Doctors are coming back from Gaza and giving that testimony to parliamentary committees. So it's a really profound crisis. And I think that's why you see different reactions across Europe. They don't know how to respond. On the one hand, do they say, look, anything goes. It's barbarism. If Israel wants to kill, then let them kill. And that's you have to suck on it. Or do they say, yes, we have some commitment to human rights, as we have always claimed, and therefore we will have to distance ourselves from what Israel does. So they're really caught by the reality, which they've managed to conceal for a very long time. I mean, President Abraham Lincoln a long time ago famously put it, you can fool all the people some of the time and some of the people all the time. You can't fool all the people all the time.
Right.
Now, what's happening now is it's producing a crisis for the government, not in terms of immediate policy, but in terms of what people have always accepted as common sense, that we're the good guys, is now kind of fragmenting.
Okay, we have a couple of minutes left, so Mazen, the last question for you. Given all these differing views, and some countries like the U.S., for instance, not recognizing The Hague and its rulings, so what are the chances of the ICC arrest warrants to be implemented?
Well, I mean, Netanyahu obviously will be very, very careful if he tries to set foot in any country, even countries that nominally have said that we have to examine, like Germany and other countries. He will feel comfortable visiting the United States because not a signatory to the ICC. But even countries friendly to him who are signatory to the ICC, he would be afraid to go there. More importantly, I think the Israeli fear, the regime's fear on this, is that, as I said, there's a cascading event. And what I'd like, of course, for the ICC and for those who brought the cases at the ICC to bring additional cases and put the ICC in under the spotlight to take even stronger decisions, and including, by the way, getting people like Biden himself indicted, because he's a full partner in this crime of genocide.
Right. Okay, and thank you so much for the insight and contribution. Mazen Qumsiyah, Palestinian scientist and author in Belfast, Mick Napier, co-founder of the Scottish-Palestine Solidarity Campaign in Glasgow.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear listeners, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll have a look at the contents and commentaries of chapter Qasas, the 28th chapter of the Holy Quran. Dear brothers and sisters, as you were with us, we were discussing the contents of the fourth verse of Surah Al-Qasas. Now let's listen to this verse.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
Inna Fir'auna 'ala fil ardi wa ja'ala ahlaha shiy'an yastad'ifu ta'ifatan minhum. يَسْتَضْعِفُ طَائِفَةً مِّنْهُمْ يُذَبِّحُ أَبْنَاءَهُمْ وَيَسْتَحْيِي نِسَاءَهُمْ إِنَّهُ كَانَ مِنَ الْمُفْسِدِينَ
Indeed, Pharaoh exalted himself in the land and made its people into factions, oppressing a sector among them. Slaughtering their newborn sons and keeping their females alive. Indeed, he was of the corruptors.
So, now that you have been with us for a couple of programs now, you know what the story of Moses, from this aspect that this chapter wants us to know, is. The point is that it all started with how he felt exalted in the earth. I mean, in the land of Egypt, because the story of Moses and Pharaoh is taking place in the land of Egypt, where they had many kinds of pharaohs, many generations of pharaohs, and this pharaoh is just the title, it's not a specific name to somebody. Anyhow, the story of Moses starts, as this chapter wants us to know, by this way, إِنَّ فِرْعَوْنَ عَلَى فِي الْأَرْضِ He exalted himself in the land. وَجَعَلَ أَهْلَهَا شِيَعًا He made the dwellers, he made the people of that land into different groups. يَسْتَضْعِفُ طَائِفَةً مِّنْهُمْ He tried to weaken one group of them. And that group were the ones who were the Septons, the ones who were the descendants of the prophet Israel. Now, why would he do that? Because they were the ones who had migrated to that land many years ago, and from the point of view of Pharaoh, they did not deserve to have the opportunities in that land. So how did he try to actually weaken them? He tried to gain control over their generation. يُذَبِّحُ أَبْنَاءَهُمْ He tried to kill and slaughter all of their boys. Why? Because the children of Israel, this generation that could stand against Pharaoh and against the cruelties of the government, were only the male generation of the children of Israel. So that's why those girls and women were left living, but since they knew that these girls and women alone did not have the power of struggling against them, they left them alive. So it says that even in the other verses of the Holy Quran, it is mentioned that keep their women alive. And this indicates that they wanted to keep the girls and women alive, either for those females might serve them, or for their lusts, or both of them. It could be for the same, I mean, both aims as well. Anyway, in the last sentence of this verse, as a conclusion, and also for stating a reason, the Quran says, Verily, he was of the mischief makers. إِنَّهُ كَانَ مِنَ الْمُفْسِدِينَ So, this is what this part of the verse wants us to know. Let us discuss the points of this part of the verse after a short break.
What?
So, as we said, the last part of the verse, as a conclusion, says, إِنَّهُ كَانَ مِنَ الْمُفْسِدِينَ. Verily he was of the mischief makers. So, shortly speaking, the act of the people of Pharaoh was wholly making mischief in the land. His self-superiority was a mischief, inventing a kind of life with class division in Egypt was another mischief. Torturing the children of Israel, weakening them, slaying their sons and using their daughters as slaves was their third mischief. And in addition to all these, there were many other corruptions in them too that can be understood throughout the different versions of the history that have reached us. It is natural that those who seek their self-superiority are the only the protectors of their own interests. Protecting the personal interests never agrees the protecting of the social interests, which needs justice. It needs benevolence and donation. So whatever it may be, its result is mischief in all dimensions of life. And by the way, the Arabic word yudhabbihu is derived from dhabah, which shows that the behavior of the people of Pharaoh with the children of Israel in slaying them was like killing animals. That's how brutal and cruel they were. There have been cited many stories concerning this crime of the people of Pharaoh. Some of the commentators say that Pharaoh had ordered his men to take the pregnant women of the children of Israel under an exact control. So every pregnant woman had a soldier to control her. And only the Coptic midwives were allowed to be the mission of childbirth. So that even if child was a boy, they would immediately inform the Egyptian authorities about the event, and they would come and take their prey. And it is not exactly clear how many of the babies of children of Israel were killed in this program. Some have said that its number was about 90,000, while some others say it was 100,000. Anyway, the numbers are breathtaking. They imagined that by these horrible crimes, they could hinder the rising of the children of Israel and the certain accomplishment of the will of the Almighty Allah. But they did not know that no one is able to stand on the way of the will of the Almighty Allah that the next verse suggests. Thank you for staying with us, dear listeners. We ask the Almighty Allah to set us among the guided ones and the people of the straight path. والسلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Things always worked for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
In the Iranian capital, once again, Denova has brought together students eager to learn about technology and innovative ecosystems to utilize the resources available and share knowledge in order to develop their scientific and research skills.
The role of science and technology parks is mainly to help the commercialization of scientific and research activities. An important part of these activities is done by university students, but in recent years, we have organized this ceremony with a different approach to recognize the talents of students.
This groundbreaking event not only fosters global collaboration, but also provides a platform for the next generation of innovators to showcase their skills and contribute to the rapid advancement of transformative technologies.
Our goal of holding this exhibition is to promote innovation and creativity in students. The purpose of these student visits is to strike a spark in their minds so that in the years to come they will be able to be creative and design a new product through the textbooks that have been taught to them.
The third DeNova Student Technology event focuses on 10 specialized fields of programming and artificial intelligence, electricity and electronics, mechanics and precision instruments, robotics, cybersecurity, health and treatment, chemistry and synthetic materials, soft and creative industries and environments.
This greenhouse has been designed for the first time in the size of home use. And it is the first time that it has been unveiled in Iran. This greenhouse works without using soil and only with air and water.
We decided to prepare a biological mulch and place it on the soil so that it does not produce pollution during wind erosion.
Mulch is actually a cover that sits on the surface of soil and sand and sticks to it tightly, preventing particles from being suspended in the air when the wind blows.
The event serves as a significant milestone with dedicated students working together to cultivate a vibrant and future-oriented technology sector, encouraging innovation and fostering a new generation of inventors in the field.
The goal of hosting this event is to identify and nurture exceptional talents while fostering students' innovative projects and ideas. This initiative aims to empower students to develop their skills, showcase their creative potential, and contribute to the advancement of cutting-edge fields. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
Over the past month, Israel has drastically reduced aid deliveries to Gaza, severely limiting access to food and medical assistance for millions of people trapped in the territory and facing a humanitarian crisis. So many are enduring conditions reminiscent of northern Gaza, which is under weeks-long daily siege and assault, with around half of the population, the Gazan population, being children. The risk of malnutrition and dehydration is high, as they dream of only one vegetable or fruit.
We used to buy chicken, meat and everything else regularly on Fridays before the war. This Friday, however, we have nothing, not even a single loaf of bread. We spend the entire day waiting in line for bread at bakeries, but we never get any. Even if we find fruits, vegetables or any other type of food, the prices are extremely expensive. I haven't had anything since this morning. While no one is paying attention, we are experiencing unprecedented famine.
I just want a proper meal, like meat. Today, all we had were some za'atar and a few fava beans. I went to the charity for food, but it was closed. This happens every day. I often end up with nothing on my plate.
In Gaza, children wait in long lines for a single plate of food, which often fails to satisfy their hunger. Their days are filled with either forced work or some boring playtime, providing only a temporary distraction from the ongoing Israeli attacks. Israel has killed over 17,000 children in Gaza, while other children either injured in Gaza's hospitals or displaced in tented camps are facing starvation. These children endure unimaginable pain and panic as the famine continues to escalate across the besieged strip. Abu Bakr Abid, Deir al-Balah, Gaza.
The streets of Sana'a came alive once again as hundreds of thousands of Yemenis poured in to protest against the Israeli genocide in Gaza. The demonstrators were united not only in their condemnation of the Israeli regime, but also in their outrage at the United States' veto of a UN Security Council draft resolution that demanded an immediate and unconditional ceasefire in Gaza. Many Yemenis see this as a blatant betrayal of justice and a green light for further Palestinian suffering.
The American veto is nothing new. They are the architects of the aggression in Gaza, Lebanon, and now the Red Sea. The West has sponsored this Zionist regime since World War II with the goal of occupying Muslim lands.
The Ansar Allah resistance movement revealed during the rally that its fighters had successfully targeted Israel's Nevatim airbase in the southern Negev region.
The missile force of the Yemeni armed forces carried out a precise operation targeting the Nevatim military airbase linked to the Israeli enemy using a Palestine 2 hypersonic ballistic missile. The operation successfully achieved all its objectives.
The weekly protests, coupled with Yemen's growing military actions, signal the country's commitment to actively supporting Palestine and Lebanon, both politically and militarily.
The leader of the Ansar Allah movement has urged the Muslim world to take action in order to end the Israeli genocide of Palestinians and achieve complete liberation of the Muslim world from Western domination. Yusuf Mawdi, Sana'a.
It has been a year since a four-day humanitarian pause was declared in the Gaza Strip. At the time, hopes were high that this could finally bring an end to the suffering of Palestinians in Gaza. However, all hopes were dashed after the Israeli regime resumed attacking the besieged territory. Now, 1 year on, there is no end in sight to the onslaught as the Israeli regime passes ahead with its attacks.
The bombings we are hearing are a clear example of the Israeli terror that has not stopped for over a year, and the regime still refuses to end its genocidal campaign. A year ago, we thought that this genocide ended, but all we have is more suffering.
Palestinians say the Israeli regime should heed international calls and stop its aggression in Gaza to allow the displaced families to return to their homes.
We were very pleased with last year's truce announcement. We thought and hoped that it would put an end for this onslaught. But here we are, after an entire year, still waiting for the moment a permanent ceasefire is announced again. We are exhausted and just want to return to our homes in northern Gaza.
Since October last year, the Israeli regime has rejected all ceasefire deals and hampered all efforts to put an end to the war.
Those against?
The U.S. this week vetoed a UN Security Council resolution that called for a ceasefire in Gaza. The draft resolution aimed for an immediate, unconditional, and permanent ceasefire in Gaza, alongside a demand for the release of all Israeli captives held by Hamas. The measure received 14 votes in favor, with the U.S. the sole member to reject it.
1 year ago, Gazans held into fragile hope that the Israeli genocide was finally coming to an end. However, today they are left grappling with uncertainty as they navigate the harsh realities of the current situation. They find themselves asking if they will ever breathe that long-awaited sigh of relief again. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis.
Thousands of Jordanians took part in a massive rally in Amman after Friday prayers, protesting Israel's recent statements about displacing Palestinians from the occupied West Bank. They condemned the remarks as part of the Zionist agenda to undermine the Palestinians' right to statehood.
The annexation of the West Bank is no longer a matter of isolated statements from extremists. It has become a central agenda of the Israeli regime. The U.S. administration clearly refuses to recognize that the West Bank is under occupation and the plans to displace Palestinians and annex the territory amounts to declaration of war on Jordan. The so-called two-state solution and peace settlement are now effectively dead. Incoming U.S. President Donald Trump has explicitly stated that Israel is small and needs to be expanded. We reaffirm our unity in opposing the Zionist agenda and rejecting these dangerous schemes.
Participants in the rally organized by the Islamic movement in Jordan under the slogan Annexation of the West Bank, a declaration of war on Jordan, warned against the potential evacuation of certain areas in the occupied territories, similar to the situation in Gaza. They also raised concerns about Israeli threats to Jordan, stressing the need to strengthen the internal front in response to these challenges.
In this march, we reaffirm our rejection of the far-right Israeli cabinet's plans, including the annexation of the occupied West Bank and the Judaization of Al-Quds. It is imperative that all ties with this Israeli entity be severed, and our internal front must be strengthened to prepare for confronting this aggression and the regime's expansionist ambitions.
We are here to deliver several messages, including one to the international community. Israel's decision to annex the West Bank is, politically, a declaration of war on Jordan and an attempt to reshape the West Asia by displacing Palestinians in the West Bank and dissolving the Palestinian Authority. We must confront this looming threat and firmly state that we will not allow such actions.
Participants condemned the statements of certain Israeli officials and denounced their racist, inflammatory, and extremist comments that advocate for Israeli sovereignty over the occupied West Bank and the expansion of settlements. Jordanians continue to protest against Israel's atrocities, condemning the ongoing genocide of Palestinians in Gaza and severe violations of the Wadi Araba Treaty. Zaid Agarbi, Amman.
Yours truly, as a soldier commissioned by yourself in this mission, upon completing the operation to liberate Abu Kamal, the last stronghold of Daesh, and lowering the flag of this American Zionist group and raising the flag of Syria, I announce the end of the rule of this accursed evil tree.
That was part of Commander Qasem Soleimani's letter to the leader of the Islamic Republic of Iran, announcing the success of his forces in defeating Daesh terrorist group and freeing their last stronghold. And today, the anniversary of this success has been named National Heroes Day in the country in the loving memory of this commander, who was in the end assassinated by the U.S.
This is the nature of imperialism. Whoever stands in the way of their interests, they'll either try to buy him off or they'll assassinate him. Martyr Soleimani wouldn't be bought off with money. He wouldn't stray from his path with the promise of material gain. So, they decided to assassinate him.
The Daesh terrorist group, which was initially created by the U.S., attracted more terrorists in the region and mobilized them against countries that resisted the Israeli occupation.
Commander Soleimani successfully dealt a significant blow to the Western Front, particularly the U.S., as evidenced by numerous leaked documents from their own officials. For instance, during a presidential debate, Trump mentioned the role that Clinton played in creating ISIS.
She gave us ISIS as sure as you are sitting there. And what happened is now ISIS is in 32 countries, and now I listen how she's going to get rid of ISIS. She's going to get rid of nobody.
But American crimes went beyond the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Mohammad Reza Zahedi, another commander who had brought about the defeat of Daesh terrorists, was later assassinated by Israelis in line with the same policy. A crime followed by yet another assassination, that of Commander Abbas Nilforoshan.
The Islamic Republic and the Iranian nation demonstrated unwavering resilience in their fight against the terrorist-natured war targeting the Muslim world. This conflict was part of a larger U.S. strategy, in conjunction with its key ally Israel, aimed at achieving their respective goals in West Asia. Israel seeks to secure its existential interests, while the U.S. aims to regain power and influence in the region. Given this context, maintaining vigilance is crucial.
for years, Iranians have raised their children ready to fight back. Their culture of resistance is evident in the many traditions and events held to revive the memories of the heroes of resistance on occasions such as National Heroes Day. According to the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, such memoirs are more than personal stories. They are our national heritage. Preserving them helps empower our nation to overcome challenges. Therefore, as heroes battle and fall, Iranians are determined to keep their memories alive. Mariam Azarchar, Tehran.
On Wednesday, Washington voted down a resolution for ceasefire in the Gaza Strip at UN Security Council, while the other 14 members of the council voted in favor. The draft also called for release of captives held by Hamas resistance group in Gaza, but U.S. officials said the language was not strong enough as it did not condition the ceasefire on the release of captives.
We cannot support a resolution that calls for an unconditional, immediate ceasefire.
Following the vote, representatives of countries attending the Security Council session spoke out against the move.
If it were not for the repeated use of the veto by the United States or its claim that the UN Security Council resolutions are non-binding, the United Nations Security Council would not be so weak and ineffective.
For months, the U.S. has been confusing everyone and obstructing the UN Security Council efforts of developing a response to a catastrophic situation in Gaza, pandering to one side of the conflict in order to achieve its own political goals at the cost of Palestinian lives.
There's no justification whatsoever for vetoing a resolution trying to stop atrocities. No justification for that.
Iran also condemned the U.S. veto as disgraceful and said it reveals Washington's full contempt for innocent lives and peace. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas said by vetoing the resolution, the U.S. once again demonstrated its direct complicity in the aggression against Palestinians. The Palestinian Islamic Jihad also called the American administration a partner to the genocide, an accusation that is even echoed in the United States.
What this extremist government has done in Gaza is unspeakable. But what makes it even more painful is that much of this has been done with U.S. weapons and American taxpayer dollars.
Sanders was speaking ahead of a resolution seeking to block the Biden administration's recent sale of $20 billion of weapons to Israel. However, with 79 to 18 votes against the measure, the Senate blocked passage of the resolution. The U.S. provides Israel with at least $3.8 billion in military aid annually, and the Joe Biden administration has authorized $14 billion in further assistance to the regime since the Israeli genocide began.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, negative effects of backbiting. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z with me, Sister Zainab. So today I'm talking to you about these very rare circumstances when, in a sense, we are permitted to backbite. But I'm also going to be putting some huge warning signs out there for you. So you really need to be very careful. And one warning is, so listen very carefully and please be absolutely certain that you are in the circumstances where you maybe should do this permissible backbiting. So in general, what is said is that obviously we know that our basic foundation, one reason why we cannot backbite is that Allah conceals the sins and the flaws of people and they should remain hidden. Now, in circumstances where a person is, in a sense, not concealing, is very open about their violations of divine commands. Let's say, for example, people are, let's say they're in an Islamic country, or just in a in a Muslim majority environment somewhere, and they are openly, so we're talking about believers here, we're talking about Muslims, they are openly, let's say, doing something haram, they're sitting, let's say, in a park in broad daylight even, let's make it extreme, and consuming alcohol. Now, obviously, we can't say that their sins are being hidden, concealed by Allah. That's obviously not the case. They are choosing to go against Allah's commands. And some people might do that, you know, in their houses, privately. No one knows. Allah is concealed from us. But when people take it upon themselves to do something like that in open daylight for everyone, for all the other Muslims, believers to see, obviously this is where, for example, we have exceptional circumstances. Welcome back. This is A to Z on RIB English Radio. So I'm talking to you about exceptional circumstances, such as Muslims, such as believers consuming, let's say, alcohol in broad daylight in a park. So this is going against the divine command. So in these sorts of circumstances, obviously, it could be expected. And we would want people to actually talk about this, in fact, because if people, for example, ignore this and just sort of accept to walk past and say nothing. In a sense, what we do not reject, refute, might even become, sort of, let's say, use this word, normalized. So obviously, we're expecting people to say something. We're expecting people to reject this, to maybe in some circumstances go up and tell the people that what you're doing is wrong. That's, of course, our general duty to advise and admonish. That is a general duty we have at all times, basically, anyway. So in these extreme circumstances, it's obvious. However, now, there is a hadith we need to bear in mind with regard to this as well. So, for example, the Holy Prophet is said to have said that blessed is the man who's been detained by his own defects from noticing the defects of other people. So, in this context, what we have to also be very sure about is that, obviously, we, for example, if we see that someone's doing something haram openly, we have to make sure at the same time that our hearts are free of, let's say, any malice towards that person or these people. For example, if we have an issue with some of these people who are doing these haram things openly and we want to admonish and refute them openly because of that, then that, again, is not appropriate. We need to make sure that the reason, the intention we have for admonishing, for refuting their behavior is pure. That obviously that this is to please Allah, that we're refuting these bad deeds and that we're trying to obviously keep the community, keep the Islamic society safe, and so we can actually do something to stop these haram acts. So these are just a few insights for you. It's a very difficult topic. Inshallah, you've learned just a little bit, and inshallah, you tune into another episode of A to Z on with me, Sister Zainab. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z. And for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
A recent report published by Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist Seymour Hersh indicates that a plan is in motion for Israel to formally annex the occupied West Bank within the next weeks. This is said to be part of a broader comprehensive